Well, we've certainly had some extreme weather in the last few weeks, haven't we? Across the country, but Wisconsin was certainly not spared, especially the northern part of the state. We had some really tough weather, and we'll talk about that and other weather and climate issues as we visit with our guest today, John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. John, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
And Steve Martin. He is a kind of a comedian.
Give me a banjo.
Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW. He's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. You may have a question about the weather, maybe a comment about the weather, what it was like in your area. Hope you'll join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. What was going on with all these heavy storms that we've had over the last few weeks?
You know, I say maybe a better question is how come it took so long? Because all other parts of the country were getting hammered for a long part of the summer. It finally invaded our state right around the 12th. I guess up in the northern counties, they really had a bad day on the 11th and 12th. And, yeah, amazing. You know, dew points in the mid to high 70s routinely across the state. Little waves coming along in the flow that's enough to turn this humid, hot and humidity conditions into some really incredible rainfall events, which we've had in a lot of parts of the state.
Yeah,
it was incredible. I mean, the flooding up north was really bad.
Yeah.
And then down here in southern Wisconsin, I mean, we got a lot of rain. I don't think we really probably had some flash and localized flooding,
yeah,
but not in Washington.
The concern was high, but I don't know if it really came to the same fruition as it did in the north. Yeah.
I think it was more of an issue of blowing down trees and
right.
taking out power lines and stuff.
We had
like
about
that.
5 inches total of rain.
I had about 5 inches in my house, too, yeah.
And there were some that had more than that in the Dane County regional area, not just the county itself, but, yeah, that's a lot of rain.
Yeah, I had 3 inches in one day and 2 inches on the next.
Yeah, same with me.
Much, yeah.
Same with me.
We had, and then you look at some parts of, well, let's see, southeastern Wisconsin. There are some counties down there that, as I was looking at the weather forecast on TV, they were showing those bright yellow corners. And this is a couple weeks back now that were in drought conditions.
Mm, not anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. At least it's been substantially alleviated, I guess. Yeah. That was pretty wild.
Well, already Don in Warren, Illinois has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling.
We've seen Charlie Watts for the last of the 5,000, the poor old cow with a wool shirt on it. And Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote the book, The Long Hard Winter. And what was interesting to me was the old Indian had foresight enough to stamp his staff on the ground 7 times, and he said it'd be 7 moons that the winter would last. You know, what kind of intuition did he have, and what year was it?
Good question. I would guess it was, I'm thinking the really bad winter in the West was 1886 or 87 or
yeah.
two.
Or 80-81 was
or
really
80,
bad.
Yeah,
a couple
yeah.
of really bad snowstorms that year. But.
Yeah, that I think that's it. It was in the 1880s or something, and it really wiped out. Back then, they were doing a lot of open range cattle ranching and things like that as well, and a lot of cattle died.
Yeah. I don't know what the one in the Wilder books was, though, probably in the late 1840s or something, but I don't know if there's not a substantial enough instrumented record in the central part of the United States at that time to really know, not till the really severe winter of the early 1880s, whenever it actually was. Yeah. I don't know either. But in terms of Native American weather prediction, I'll tell you one thing. Certainly, they didn't have the sophistication in their measurement and modeling approach that we have today. That's just a function of the inventions hadn't been made yet. But you can't live in that part of the world for generation upon generation without having some very highly tuned intuition and instinct about how to read the sky and how to read things on the horizon and shelter in place. So I have a feeling they were really, really smart about the weather. And I've always wondered, I talked to some guy when I first came here 22 years ago, he was at Montana State, American Indian expert, about what's the oral tradition among the Sioux and the Lakota Sioux and all them about weather. And he said he was not aware of much, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So it'd be really nice to track that down and, you know, try and marry it to what we actually know now in a more scientific way about the weather in this part of the world. I think it would be really fascinating.
I was reminded, several years back now, talking about Alaska and in that area, the Eskimos having like 60 different terms for snow or something like some ungodly.
Yeah, no, yeah, a lot of terms for snow and none for lightning. And thunder, and they've just recently, in the last maybe 10 years or so, been seeing and hearing lightning up there.
But it goes to your comment that you know, when you live in that kind of area, you really learn to discriminate.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What's going on,
right.
they could discriminate different types of snow much more than I certainly could.
Yeah, I think so, for sure.
Yeah, to me, there's heavy snow and light snow.
Yeah,
and I mean from the shovel point of view.
Yeah, right. And it would be interesting to know, for instance, you know, maybe you could imagine some of the Indian tribes in the southwest United States where the weather is probably more benign, especially like at the level of Tucson, something like that, where it doesn't get too hot, doesn't get too cold. Yeah. You might not have as much weather vocabulary in such a language. It just doesn't matter as much as it does in the high plains of North America. It would be really interesting to know that.
Don, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Glenn in Gordon, Wisconsin, your turn now. Hi, Glenn.
Good morning. I got a question about lightning. We had a severe thunderstorm come through our town on Wednesday night, and several people said it was the loudest crack of lightning they've ever heard. Hmm. And we've had several people that lost TVs. We lost our furnace, gas lines, all kinds of stuff in our house. Is it possible for that lightning, even though it doesn't hit the ground, to cause damage like that to our property?
I'm going to guess it either, yes, it is. And I would guess, particularly if it was the loudest that you've heard, that it hit nearby. It could have hit the house and come in, or it could have hit the ground and then traveled along in the ground to the house. I know that's what happened to my parents' house. They lost all their electronics, just like you're describing. Mm-hmm. My dad took me outside and wanted to show me something. And what he showed me was, about, you know, maybe 10, 15 yards from the house, there was this big divot. And then there was this line of dead grass that ran right to the house.
Oh, boy.
And so I said, well, that's probably where the lightning struck and got into the house. And once it gets into the house, you know, particularly if it's a big bolt, it's going to travel around and just destroy any electronics that it could get into.
Go ahead.
Would that be able to travel to other people's houses? I'm going to say probably a 2 or 3 block radius. All got their electronics destroyed.
So what came to my mind is I've seen these pictures on a golf course, on a golf green, where a flagpole got hit and then dead grass again that just spiraled out. So one thing that could have happened in terms of hitting multiple houses is it could have hit something, hit the ground, or hit something that got and then traveled into the ground and then, you know, traveled out radially from that ground spot, in which case, again, you would impact several houses.
Yeah.
But we've never been able to find any lightning strike with several people looking around for it.
Oh, okay.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think I agree with Steve. There's probably a ground zero somewhere. Maybe it's less obvious. Maybe it is on a grassy field. Maybe the side of somebody's house or another building got struck and it was brought right into the ground, even on a cement paved way or something, and went underground, something like that. So it's harder to detect. But it seems like that would have to be the case.
And another option might be, if you think, in addition to cloud-to-ground lightning, there's also cloud-to-cloud. And sometimes in a really active storm, you'll see those horizontal lightning bolts. Mm. So, I mean, one can imagine a horizontal one just traveling just above the level of the rooftops. Mm. And then, you know, things coming off each one of that line hitting
true
a house individually.
Yeah, so nothing hits the ground.
Yeah.
Because that night, the whole sky was lit up like totally the whole night or for about an hour in there.
Yeah. Amazing.
Constant lightning.
And actually, you know, we see a single bolt, but actually there are multiple bolts within that single one. Our eyes just can't distinguish it. So it could be that it is one bolt that was taking different paths, slightly different paths to hit different houses.
Interesting. Amazing. Thanks. So, you know, I'm thinking back on Thursday night of last week. I had a meeting and I was in a building with a vaulted ceiling and I happened to be looking out and it was all pretty much all glass. Mm. And I saw, you know, during the meeting, it was hard to concentrate on the meeting because the sky was just lightning bolts across the sky everywhere. And it was scary and gorgeous at the same time.
Yeah. It's fun to watch those lightning bolts
sure
and get
There's
all
nothing
excited.
Like it. That, you sound like you had a catbird seat for that, too.
I had a perfect seat for it. I was in a building, and I was safe, and I
big
and
glass
I
windows.
Yeah, right.
Oh, man. Thanks again, Glenn, for calling. Andrew in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Great. Good. Appreciate the call.
Well, thanks for taking my call. So last night I was driving back from Milwaukee to Madison, and it was a really nice sunset, but we noticed there was a little cloud in the sky that was all rainbow-colored, and there was no other rainbow around it, and I have never seen that before. Do you guys have any idea what was going on there? Or
yeah. So
like that before?
It wasn't part of a ring or anything? It was just a cloud by itself lit up?
No, there was no rain at all, yeah.
Yeah. Ring. Yeah. R-I-N-G. It wasn't part
of a
ring
like
around
a
the
rainbow
sun.
Ring around. Yeah, okay,
no,
yeah.
And were you looking towards the sun, or was the sun forward or behind?
The sun was probably 30 degrees to the right.
Okay. Then, yeah, what it is, it's a cloud that's made up of ice crystals of a particular shape that kind of plate structured with six sides, a six-sided plate, if you think of it that way. And each one of those ice crystals acts like a prism that you put in your window, you know, those lead prisms that throw out a rainbow of colors, although they're so far away that you're only seeing a particular light ray coming from that interaction of the sun with the crystal. But because you have multiple crystals, you end up seeing a rainbow-type color in the cloud. And they're called. People call them fire on ice as an acronym because they look like they're on fire because oftentimes the structure is very wavy of the cloud. And they're made of ice. They're made of ice crystals.
Interesting.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Well,
I haven't seen it many times, but it is pretty impactful because the colors are really intense.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that.
Yeah.
No. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. We had Kevin posted on Facebook to say he used to get severe weather alerts via text message. His phone would wake him up in the night if an alert was issued, but the service was discontinued. Where can he receive a similar service?
So I would suggest one thing. I would go to the app and make sure that it is, because I know when I turn my phone off, it disconnects from those getting sent those warnings, and I got to go back into the app and tell the app to, go ahead and send me the warnings. But I know NOAA is doing that now. I mean, they're still selling the NOAA radios, but they also have, the National Weather Service has apps for those types of warnings.
The building I was in last Thursday night had an alert, and about every 10 minutes into the meeting, we get another one, and they were loud. And
yeah.
And I kind of wanted to turn them off, but...
Well, since you had such a great view, you didn't need that.
Right.
Talking with Steve Ackerman and John Martin about the weather and climate. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guests today... John Martin, professor in, of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, also a professor there, and he directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. If you have a weather or climate question, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. We always enjoy the weather photos, and if you've got a weather photo, I hope you'll post it up on our Facebook page, and certainly post a question there as well. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And email at talk@wpr.org. Denise from Plum City has a question about camping during a lightning storm. They say it's safest to set your tent up within a certain distance from a tree to be the safest in case of a lightning strike. With the recent popularity of hammock camping, are you safer in a tent set up as described above, or are you safer hanging between two trees in a hammock which doesn't touch the ground?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Good question. Most times the hammock's going to either have some sort of a metal, I don't know, maybe not most times, but you could have metal chains that connect it to the trees or something like that. I don't think that's a good idea. If you tie it with rope, then the rope gets wet, you got a conduit there. I'm not sure. I think that's a bad situation overall. I don't know what's a good option in an otherwise bad environment.
Go into your car.
Yeah, right. That's probably the best thing to do. Right, that's probably the best thing to do.
Absolutely.
I think so.
Bob and Krivitz, thanks for calling. Hi,
yes.
What's on your mind?
Hi there, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call.
Okay, this is Bob from Krivitz. I got my cabin up here. My home is south of Sheboygan by Terry Henry Park, and my home was built in 1878. It's a seven-bedroom farmhouse. I just rebuilt it, and now I just replaced the roof. I have five lightning rods on the roof. Okay, and I've got these range from 6 feet to 4 foot high. My chimneys, my tallest chimney is about 5.5 foot. I've got two chimneys, okay, and I just bought all new bulbs for them. Now to replace these, to put these back on the roof with the ground wire again, is that safe or is it not safe?
So that's a really tough question, because I really think it depends on where you are. So as you drive around in rural areas, for example, you'll see a lot of barns that have, like what you're describing, they'll have a few lightning rods that are, you know, are metal rods that are sticking up that are grounded to the ground so that if a lightning bolt is coming, in theory, it would attract more to the metal than to the wood that's there and then travel down safely down to the ground. And our building, you know, which sticks up as well, has a lot, or is ringed by lightning rods. Yeah. If you go up on the top, pointing, yeah.
Your office building.
Our office building. You know, because it's the tallest thing around. And so I think if you have a building that's out in the middle of nowhere on a hill, which barns often are, it's probably a good idea to have a lightning rod on there, particularly if there are a lot of storms in the area. When you go into towns and suburbia, you don't find it very much. And I think it's because, you know, the probability of any one of those houses getting hit is probably equal. So if you end up sticking a metal pole up, you know, you may be increasing your probability of getting hit.
Because they do, I guess, attract it a little bit, right? And that's the whole idea.
Right, they attract it away from the house.
If
it gets close, you want to hit that so that it could travel it down safely to the ground. But as we just talked to a previous person, right, once it gets in the ground, you don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah.
It could disperse in the ground and all of a sudden hit a copper pipe that's coming into your house and then travel in that way.
It's really weird.
Yeah.
There you go. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. Dave and Elroy, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How are you, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call, Dave. What can we do for you?
My question is kind of similar to the last caller's. A neighbor of mine lives probably 5-6 miles from me. We live out in the country. And he had been struck by lightning for several years, repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And he had some guys install a lightning protection system on his house. And he swears by it. He says that he has not been struck since he installed this system. And I looked at some of the literature that that company provided him. And their theory was that if they install a lightning protection system, that it won't attract lightning and cause it to run into the ground, but it'll make that building less attractive to lightning. Hmm. And I was curious on what your guests had to say about that.
Hmm.
So it's trying to, I mean, when lightning builds up and strikes, the objects on the ground are getting charged. And so what they're arguing is they're trying to discharge the extra charges that are building up on the house. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure I go along with that one.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
But the key is that it's worked, right?
So, well, yeah, except
he swears by it. So.
Yeah. He may be getting hit, and again, not well, you would hear it, I would think.
You'd hear it.
The cracking sound. Yeah.
I'm glad it's worked for him, but without knowing more, it's hard to know whether or not there's really any truth to that claim. It just might be something funny going on there.
So do you think, the reason I called is because I'm debating on whether getting the system installed myself. So do you think there is benefits to having them versus not having them?
I
have a barn on my property, too, you know, that doesn't have them right now. So
I would think that if you got a barn out there on a hill out in the open, then, you know, having something to try and protect against getting hit, or if it does get hit, to keep the energy from flowing into the building is probably a good idea.
Yeah, and in whatever literature or whatever sales pitch they give you, if they don't talk about dissipating the buildup of charge, then I'd kind of be suspect. If they do talk about that and they got a technology that helps the building do that, then they're actually providing you something that's valuable, I think.
Yeah, that's basically what it said, that it dissipated the buildup of whatever static electricity or whatever that would be built up in that house, which would make that building less attractive to life.
And I'd like to know, I'd ask them, how does it do that, and, you know, what's the principle, and maybe they tell you. So
and I would still make sure it's grounded. You know?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
another thing. In case of dissipating it, would yep. you need it to be grounded?
Awesome.
All right, Dave, call
well,
back and let us. Yeah, call back
yeah,
and let us know
yeah,
what
they
know
say.
What they
say. We'll
when
look
you
into
ask that question.
A little bit better.
Pam and Leo in Half Lake, Minnesota. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hello, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Okay, so we hope you can explain the phenomena. We were at Star Island at Cass Lake, northern Minnesota, about 90 miles south of the Canadian border, and very bad storms last week, lots of devastation with trees. A friend's sailboat, a Catalina, I would guess about 22 feet long, about a ton and a half, about 30 yards off the shore of the island, the east shore of the island.
Was that the Windward Shore? Was that the Windward Shore of the island?
Yes. Well, in this case, during the storms, it was.
Okay.
It was a northeast wind, and it was a shore station not attached to the dock, but about 30 yards off the shore, elevated due to the, such shallow water. The phenomena was as followed. The next morning after the storm subsided, the sailboat was missing.
Whoa.
Off the shore station. This would be the east shore of the island.
Mm.
And the later in the day, the sailboat was found on the west shore of the island.
Mm.
Now, as the crow flies, it would be about 3 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But it was found intact, in pretty decent shape, but it was skipperless. We're just wondering, I mean, we knew we had terrible winds, but maybe you could share with us from your expertise what you think happened.
So it went against the wind, in other words. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know if the north, it could
no,
be
it went
that
downwind.
It was
downwind.
It could be that it was, we believe it was when we went down at 4:30 in the morning, and it was probably a northeast wind coming in, mostly north.
Okay,
coming in strong, and so to have gone around the island, it would have had to have gone out beyond the point, around past the south shore of the island, and end up on the west shore. So as the crow flies, it might be 2 miles, but directionally, if you were going to sail it with the skipper, somebody at the helm, it probably would be more like 5 miles.
Mm. Yeah. So is this island kind of wedge-shaped? Is it longer than it is wide?
Star-shaped.
Star-shaped, okay. And it's heavily...
hence the name Star Island.
Okay, yeah, I guess you said that. And is it heavily vegetated?
Yes.
Tall trees, pine trees, and so on?
Yes.
Yeah, so...
In the 1930s, there was a big blowdown of, old-growth fir, and so you have only a few of those left. So it's mostly basswood, white pine, birch, heavily forested.
Okay. So I'm wondering, I'm going to throw this out. The boat did move downwind. So if the wind is prevailing winds from the northeast and it ends up from the eastern shore to the western shore, it ended up going around the island in the direction of the prevailing wind. But I wonder if, because of the shape and the vegetated topography of the island, that you had a really interesting phenomena, and I don't know how it would affect the currents. That might be an interesting part of the problem here. But the pressure was certainly going to be higher on the windward side of the island and much lower on the leeward side, the western side in this case. And that's going to help to produce little eddies in the atmosphere that kind of would compel anything in the air to move around the island towards the west coast. It may also compel currents to come from what might be a slack condition to a really strong condition right around the perimeter of the island and dragging them always down in the same direction downwind, so from east to west. So I don't know if that's what happened or not.
But that makes sense.
One other piece that would go align with what you're saying that could have contributed to it is, I believe it's one of the only places in the United States that has an island on a lake where there is a lake also inside the island.
Oh.
And so you have areas that would be lower from a topography standpoint, highs and lows.
Mm.
And, the devastation with regard to wind, there's a lot of trees down, and there was a fair amount of damage too. I mean, there was so much wind, it physically cartwheeled some shore stations, some boats were thrown off, and plenty of trees are down.
Wow.
Not one you want to be out in.
No kidding.
No kidding.
It's about 14 miles east of Bemidji.
Oh.
Do they know why it broke loose?
We We don't know. And the curious thing, too, is that we had a canoe. We have a canoe, aluminum craft canoe, that was fastened onto both bow and stern onto our dock, sort of the, you know, the plank dock, old-fashioned, fairly close to shore. And two nights in a row, that physically broke loose without breaking the ropes and without breaking the dock. So somehow the wave action in the air and the wind must have been sufficient to...
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. If it, it with the really sailboat tough. Anyway, if it separated it with the offshore connection because water levels raised because the wind's blowing it up or something. But it'd have to be pretty tightly tied, I think, to that buoy for that to happen.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, and believe it or not, it wasn't buoyed. It actually was on a physical shore station, but about 30 yards off.
Oh, okay.
Offshore.
Wow.
Was there an anchor out? That could have been the other reason that... you know, an anchor dragging may have caused it to take
They wouldn't
a turn
have an
too.
Anchor on a shore station.
No, though. That's right, yeah.
No. You wouldn't have had that, but there would have been a keel that you would probably
right.
have wrapped on it was at least 3 feet.
Yeah.
Ugh. Very, thank you.
Very, yeah, crazy. Anyway, thanks for having your show.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, appreciate it. Very, really interesting. What, Mike in Kakana has something for us. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. A couple of questions. We've had, as Wisconsin, across Wisconsin, the last couple of weeks have been some severe thunderstorms. I live in the Fox Valley area, but we were in Waupaca about 2 weeks ago, and actually out on the water in a pontoon boat, and thunderstorm activity was moving around. I have never seen such a variety of clouds in my life. I'm retired, so I've looked at the sky for a lot of years. But there was cirrus, there was cumulus, there were thunderheads. It just all different descriptions and moving very fast, but ones that I've never seen before mixed in with all these others. I don't know the name of them, but they looked like marshmallows. Yeah. And they were in rows, consecutive rows mixed in amongst all these other clouds that were changing. It was just phenomenal. If you remember the old Parker House rolls, when you'd pick up a package of those in the grocery store, that's what they looked like. It looked like packs of Parker House rolls in the sky. So that was 2 weeks ago. And then just this week, we had a thunderstorm come through here, and it was more to the south of us. But again, there was a lot of cloud activity at sunset. And there again, I saw these same marshmallowed formations of clouds. The whole sky was full of them, and the sun was setting, and it was like a pale yellow, then egg okra yellow, and then pinkish. It was just magnificent, but I've never seen those shaped clouds before.
Yeah, those are fairly common in and around thunderstorms, especially ones that are very intense. They're known as mammatus clouds.
Okay.
And it comes from the Latin to, you know, suggesting of breasts and so on. They kind of look that way, too, I guess. But they're mammatus clouds. They're very common in severe weather environments. But we don't really have a great understanding of what forces them to have that look. Because we believe one of the prevailing theories is that the protruding cloud comes down in a downdraft. But then, of course, the mystery is how does a cloud remain in air that's subsiding, because that air usually dries out a little bit as it subsides and warms up. So it's a real mystery, but they are very characteristic of severe weather environments, although you don't always see them in association with them.
If
you're in the wrong part
life.
Of a storm. Yeah.
Yeah, first time in my life I've ever seen them. And the ones just this week to the west as the sun was setting, the whole sky was just full of them. You almost felt like you were on a different planet.
Yeah, it's awesome when you see that kind of skyscape.
Yeah, it was just, I thought, wow, I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, so, they are spectacular.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. John from Wausau says he has the weather vane lightning rods that are not grounded. Is this safe? Are lightning rods effective? Well, we've talked about
If it's not grounded, that's usually not a good thing.
No.
Because that means the energy is going to stay in the house or on the roof or wherever it hits.
So not a good plan.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Marcus in Green Bay next. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. Last week we had a line of thunderstorms rolled through early in the day, and the temperature was about 87 degrees, and the dew point was 77. And then a little later on in the afternoon, I was in a grocery store,
another, kind of like a cell of thunderstorms moved just to the south of us. We could see the lightning and everything. When I came out of the grocery store, my glasses steamed up immediately. And it was kind of comical, you know. And then so I got in my van and I checked the weather on the local weather station about a three-quarters of a mile away, said that it was 77 dew point, about 87 degrees. But it, when you walked out of the store, it seemed like a sauna. So I was just wondering, how high can a dew point actually get around here to cause something like that?
I had the same issue. Yeah. I've had it.
I had it a couple of times, too, coming out of stores or even coming out of our house, which was cooler, but we didn't have the air conditioner on.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's just sitting around the dew point.
Yeah, it's amazing. The highest dew point I've ever experienced in my 22 years living in this great state was 81 degrees Fahrenheit. That was July 13th, 1995. So we've had in Madison an 81-degree dew point, which is exceptionally vapor-laden. There are places in Iowa at this time of year when the corn is just getting premature, it's almost mature, is when you can have dew points in the mid-80s on extreme days. I think, in fact, the other day, it wasn't Dubuque, it might have been someplace in the central part of the state, I saw on a map the dew point was 83. So I think that's about the limit to where you can get the dew point out in this part of the country. That's exceptionally high. It doesn't get much higher anywhere else in the world. In places on the North Carolina coast, in a real heat wave like they're having right now, you might see a place like, Newport, I think, has a dew point sometimes in the mid-80s. I've seen 85. That's about the highest I've ever seen a reported dew point in the continental United States. So when you get to 77, like you had the other day in your locale, that's about the limit, but not quite the limit. And we've been a little bit higher in the southern part of our own state. Now, pretty amazing. Places in Ethiopia can have dew points in the high 80s,
yeah,
routinely. They average a dew point of 84 in Addis Ababa in the month of July.
Oh.
Average.
Oh, yeah. Man.
So a humid day there is 90.
Oh, man.
Unbearable.
Sherry in Richland Center, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I appreciate you talking about climate change. And I wanted to make a comment about, you were talking about American Indians and Native Americans earlier.
Yeah.
And I wanted to correct a misperception. In fact, Native people were some of the best and earliest scientists. They have incredible observation skills. And in fact, in Alaska, the Alaska Native Science Commission has joined with them since the early 90s to help them document climate changes that have been happening there. And there's a really great couple of websites, nativescience.org, and I think it's indigenousknowledge.org. And they've really been aware of just the remarkable nature of the way that Native people use their observations of animal behavior, plant changes in the plants coming up, and they really, it's really scientific the way they understand the natural world.
Yeah, I think that's what John was alluding to when he made that comment, because I mean, our field, primarily weather field in general, is an observational science. And so back before instrumentations, you had to be a very careful science approach to observations in order to try and do forecasting.
Yeah.
I think it would be great to partner more with some of the tribes and some of the elders that have this knowledge, and to really, help us understand what's going on. What they've seen. So thanks.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a photo up on our Facebook page from Richard, a sunrise over Green Bay. Somebody else mentioned a kind of a yellowish sky. Yeah. I know my daughter was at camp last week, and she was commenting about the yellow sky.
We had great sunsets for the last 4 days after these storms,
where
they just turn that orange and yellow bright colors.
And it's caused by...
The blue light gets scattered out, and then the advantage is when you have clouds, that the clouds, since the blue light's gone, the clouds will reflect that and really light the sky up. Otherwise, if you have a clear sky, they're usually not dynamic because it's just very layered, subtle colors, and the clouds allow those colors to stand out.
And I think some of the Thursday night had to have been accentuated by some of those highest clouds still dropping precipitation particles out that were not quite reaching the ground anymore, maybe an occasional spit of drizzle. But you could see, you know, that's got to enhance the reflection of that low-energy light, that yellow light. It was just dramatic.
Spit of drizzle. That's a technical term.
Yeah, spit of drizzle. I don't want to get too technical on you, but, you know.
Well, guys, here we are out of time. Lots of callers yet, but we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us, and you'll be back the last Monday of...
August.
Right. I was trying to think what month.
It's the beginning, it's the beginning of our new academic year.
Yeah, that's right. How can I forget that?
Yeah. Right.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. They'll be back on August 29th. Oh, man. Tomorrow, at this time, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk joins us to talk about your pet's health. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.